at 10 o'clock, so let's get moving here. Welcome, I hope you had a good summer, those who I have not already seen in classes this past week. I missed everybody, but so it goes. Looking forward to the series starting after Sukkot. I think our first series is going to start October 13th, it is. And the topic is building off of what we did in June. Everybody wanted to talk more about those figures from Sephardic Jewry. So we're going to be talking about Spanish philosophers. Los Pensadores, I think, is the way to pronounce that word. So I will make a flyer, send it out, and hopefully people will register for it. That starts in mid-October, so we have some time.
That's good pronunciation, Rabbi.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Also, I actually had a question, which I may put out in an email. You know, my Beit Midrash program is not just me. There are others in the program as well. Some of you went to classes with Rabbi Ziering, Rabbi Bergman. So we now have a young Israeli fellow in our program who is very enthusiastic and very eager, and he has very good English. He wants to also offer classes, and in particular in Jewish philosophy, Jewish thought. And so there's a possibility not to take away from our Wednesday morning classes, but to add something, you know, in an afternoon, for example. So I'm curious whether people would be interested in an added option. I'm seeing some yeses. Okay, so that's very good to know. Okay, so stay tuned for more about that. Our topic for today, preparing for Rosh Hashanah, is birthday of Adam or birthday of Eve. And I wanted to begin with what you see at the top of the source sheet, and some people have joined since I posted the link, so I'm going to post the link again. Just click on that and you should be able to see the source sheet. I'm beginning with an email that I received, as I wrote on the sheet, in August 2013. It was a very long email. This is just a brief excerpt from it. It was from a fellow who grew up observant, went to schools, you know, standard Jewish schools, in New York. And he had a relative who, at some point, felt their own faith challenged and ultimately walked away from observance and became an avowed atheist. And the relative took it upon himself, or herself, I don't know, to convince this fellow that he should also walk away, to argue with him about Judaism, about the Torah, to challenge his beliefs, and this relative succeeded in undermining his faith. And this person emails me, and it's a very long email, with all his different questions and issues with Judaism. And in particular, I wanted to highlight for our purposes what I brought you here in source number one, in which he writes, "At present, I have given up faith and lead a life in limbo, and have done so for the better part of a decade. I am left lost, wandering, in constant existential angst. I live the life of Kohelet." Kohelet is the book of Ecclesiastes, which voices great skepticism regarding some central beliefs of Judaism, minus the last lines, because the last lines of that book are that in the end, a person should fear God, keep the mitzvot, because that's all of a person's existence. So he says, I haven't gotten to that. I am not at that stage. I'm at the stage of all of the doubt. I cannot find that God to whom I must obey his commandments. So all that is left is the knowledge, and he's quoting Ecclesiastes, that all is nothingness, all is worthless. I'm desperate to return to the frum world, the observant world, where I once belonged, desperate for that faith which sustained me and gave purpose to my life and reasons for my actions, but hopelessly alienated and unfortunately intellectually quite secure in my knowledge of the absence of any possible truth in it." He says he's 100% convinced that Judaism isn't true. He misses it. And he's challenging me, essentially, in his email to help him to return. If you got an email like that, out of curiosity, how would you respond?
He needs help, for sure. He sounds very depressed, obviously. Very, very depressed. Difficult for him to even write this. Yet he's seeking some kind of structure because now he's in sort of a chaotic world now. He doesn't have the structure of Yiddishkeit or from, or, and he knows this.
He knows some Torah, yes, and he's definitely distraught, definitely depressed, and it really comes through more in the rest of the email, and it's a point that I'm going to come back to at the end, that he's also, it's very clear from the email and in my follow-ups with him, he acknowledged it, this is who has a separate problem, which is that he's dating, and in trying to find somebody for himself, he wants somebody in the observant community, but he's not observant, but that's the community that he feels he belongs to. That is what really forces his hand here, I think. I see a few hands. Rose, you used the Zoom hand-up method, so that's
so
the...
I just want to say that two parts of our identity, there's religion and there's race. I don't want... Race is such a politically incorrect thing, so... For me, if I got that, I'd say, look, identify with who you are as a person, as a tribe. And even if you don't believe, because sometimes people don't know, right? It's a question mark. So say you don't believe, you still follow the rituals because it's part of your identity, and therefore it'll help you bring you back to your own identity and your own who you are, and then. The rest, you can believe, you don't have to believe, it matters not. That's how I would have answered.
Okay. So orthoprax, effectively.
Yeah.
To do it without necessarily believing it.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah.
Claudette.
I got an email like that. I don't know that I would be giving him advice directly because he sounds confused. He's already been pressured by someone else to think otherwise. I would think that I would go to what I would think that the Rebbe would do. It's just start with one mitzvah with this individual.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a possible approach. You're also taking the very practical approach as opposed to discussing the philosophy of it. Okay,
yes.
Susan.
He's confused. You can't join the philosophy with somebody.
Yes.
So confused.
No, that's true. Susan?
I remember when you taught us the Yonah class,
mm-hmm.
and you discussed why Yonah was in the web, inside the fish for 3 days. And you said because he missed, if I misquote you correctly, you said because he missed the life of being with God. He missed that connection that he had when he was ready to
yes.
give it all up. And it took him 3 days to think it out. And realized how that connection meant something to him. And he needed that connection. It sounds to me like even if he's depressed and whatever, he's in the place that Yonah was in some ways. And he really misses that connection, but he doesn't know how to get back into where he was with God.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously that connection was so much part of his life that he does miss it.
Yeah.
He doesn't know how to...
And I think that's a really important point, and the way he misses it really comes through. I definitely agree. All right, let's discuss this a little further as we go through what we have here for the class. But I want to come back to all of these different points.
Can you mute us?
I can always mute you. Yes. So it's a particular problem as people approach Rosh Hashanah, right? And it's not lost on me that his email came in August, in the build-up to Rosh Hashanah. This is a day that's dedicated to acknowledging God as King and Creator of the universe. What can someone like this do on Rosh Hashanah? So I want to begin by looking at Rosh Hashanah as the birthday of humanity. I see some people here who are actually at my class on Tuesday afternoon. that I, you know, that I gave yesterday. This, some of this will actually end up fitting very nicely into what we said then, even though I don't plan to go into Job, at all. So, first of all, important to recognize, because some people are surprised always to hear this, Rosh Hashanah is the birthday of humanity, not the birthday of the universe. There's a classic prayer that is said on Rosh Hashanah when we blow shofar, Hayom Haras Olam. Today is the conception of the world, the universe. And it makes it sound like Rosh Hashanah is supposed to be the anniversary of creation. However, it's not. It's not the anniversary of day one. It's the anniversary of day six. And I brought you one midrash to illustrate it. There are many. In source number two, where we are taught in the name of Rabbi Eliezer, one of the sages of the Mishnah, he said, the world was created on the 25th of Elul. Elul is the Hebrew month before Rosh Hashanah, the lunar month before Rosh Hashanah. The day one of creation is the 25th day of Elul, and then as you count forward, you realize the first day of Tishrei, which is Rosh Hashanah, is actually day six, the creation of human beings. So that's a basic thing just to be aware of. But there are two human beings created on that day. There is Adam, and then there is Chava, Eve. And whose birthday are we actually celebrating on Rosh Hashanah? You ever think about that? Which birthday are we celebrating? What would you say?
Twins.
Well, they're not twins.
They both born the same day, in that sense.
Okay.
I don't think it matters.
Diane says it doesn't matter. Okay. Sorry?
Adam is born first, but that happens with twins. You know, one follows the other.
Right.
So, but it's really Adam comes first,
right,
whether we like it or not.
Okay. So I'm hearing...
But you need the pair to... creation.
Yeah, you can't really work well with only one of them. Not until we work, not until we get cloning going, anyway.
The Adam who was created was a composite being originally, so he was really more two focuses.
Right. So Mark points out something that we're going to come back to a little bit later, which is the idea that Adam and Chava originally inhabit the same body. We're gonna mention that. It will become relevant in a bit. So
is this the androgynous theory?
Well, it's not androgynous. It's actually hermaphroditic, right? It's both.
Sorry for interrupting. Is Lilith coming anywhere here?
Sorry, no Liliths in this. The Lilith idea is a fascinating idea, but it's not in the biblical text. And we're focusing on that, and we'll see classic rabbinic writing on it, which also don't get into Lilith really.
Okay.
Fascinating issue, though.
Sorry.
No problem. So, I think there actually is a difference between celebrating the birthday of Adam and celebrating the birthday of Eve. And that's why we're having a class, because otherwise it would be a very short session. Adam is created as an intimate of God. If you take a look at source number 3 on the sheet, the description biblically of the creation of Adam. And God said, let us make man in the image and form, right? The royal we, na'aseh. We shall make man in the image and form we have designed. And he will rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, the beasts, the entire land, and all the crawling creatures that crawl upon the land. God says, and I translated this sentence in line with Rashi's commentary, that that there is a special image that God has designed for human beings. A special form, which commentators disagree about exactly what that means in God's image. One answer I brought you in source number 4, Rabbi Meir Leibush Malbim says it means the power of free will. That's the image of God that human beings are given. Others suggest it's having a soul. Rabbi Moshe Cordovero in his Tomer Devora mystical work in source number 5 says it's the ability to emulate God's ways, to be merciful as God is merciful, and so on. But no matter what approach we use to interpret image of God, there is some level of intimacy with God in being created in God's image. You are close to God. And that intimacy continues.
Actually, the next verse, it's
written. The next verse is coming up. Ruchama lo iganu leze adayin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yavo, ze b'makor shmini. So, you have this closeness to God. If you take a look at source number 6, you find that closeness to God continue. This description of how Adam ends up in the garden. And God took the man, and he placed him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to guard it. God puts man in the garden, and he gives him a personal instruction. God instructed the man, saying, "From every tree of the garden you shall eat." It is direct. It is personal. You may recall, pre-COVID, we had that session at Beth Emeth on the journey of the soul and life after death and all of that. And I quoted Rabbi Soloveitchik there, talking about how God takes Adam into his confidence and informs him of his moral will by having this first direct communication. The closeness of Adam to God may be best seen, or not best seen, but it's certainly clear in source number 7, where we are told where God took the earth that he used to create Adam, right? We're told that Adam is created with dirt from the ground. Does that mean just any ground? No, it's got to be special ground. So what is it? Jerusalem Talmud says, God took a ladleful, right, a ladleful of dirt from the place of the altar, the place where the altar would be built in the temple, the place that God is supposed to inhabit, so to speak, and used that dirt to create Adam the first, saying he should be created from the place of the altar such that he will endure. So there's a closeness to God in the place from which he is formed, in the way that he is created in this special image, in being put personally in the garden, in being given a direct instruction. Adam has a clear, close relationship with God, and that's where the relationship is. That's where the relationship continues to be, even when he sins. Yes, Marilyn.
Now, we assume from this that there was humanity before, if there was an altar.
Right, so no, there's no altar. It's the site where the altar would eventually be.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you are correct. That would be an interesting anachronism. Eve, Chava, is created with a different relationship with God. Take a look at source number 8 now, which Ruchama wanted to point to, so now you can actually see it there. And God created man in his image, right? Everyone sees that? In the image created by God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. I'm going to come back to the male and female part shortly. Actually, no, let me mention it here. Male and female, he created them, suggests that what we've been saying about the creation in God's image is not only about Adam, it's about Eve as well. She shares that creation in God's image. That she has. However, where does her material come from? Does it also come from the site of the altar?
Comes from Adam's
rib. Right, comes from Adam's... Comes from Adam, right?
But is it androgynous reading, where God is half male, half...
Adam is.
Half male, half... No, but they say God is actually androgynous, and that's why often you'll have God in the Torah. Sometimes it'll be he and sometimes it'll be she.
Right, so let me distinguish.
When we say Shekhinah, it's he.
Right, let me distinguish here. First of all,
okay.
In terms of God, neither gender is relevant because there's no body. Meaning we are identifying traits that we perceive in God's actions as traits that remind us of masculine or feminine, and you are correct. There are names of God like Shekhinah that are feminine. There are names of God that fit the masculine form like Elohim. So you are correct about that. In terms of Adam, we're going to talk about that, but again, hermaphroditic rather than androgynous. But neither here nor there. The point right now is take a look at number 9. And God settled a deep sleep upon the man, and he slept. And he took one of his sides and sealed the flesh beneath it. Note that I translated as side, not as rib. The word in Hebrew is tzela. And tzela, it's true, can be used to mean rib, but it also means side. For example, when the Torah describes the creation of the Mishkan, the tabernacle that the Jews traveled with in the wilderness, it gives you the design for the outer perimeter, and each side is called Tzela HaMishkan. So Tzela does not have to mean rib, and frankly, I mean, God can create whatever he wants out of whatever he wants, so he can turn a rib into a full-blown human being if he wishes. But it really seems more likely that it's actually the full side as opposed to the rib, especially in the context of what we're about to see in number 10. But we're not there yet. God took the side he had taken from the man, built the side, I should say, he had taken from the man into a woman, and he brought her to the man. So that whereas Adam is created from the place of the altar, Eve, Chava, is created from the recycled cells of another human being, right? Which is good. I believe in recycling. Glad that it was recycling rather than compost. But the idea is that there's less of that direct connection. Not only that, Eve seems to be absent for the original conversations between God and Adam, right? Did you notice, going back to source number 6, God instructed the man, saying, from every tree of the garden you shall eat. Where is Eve? Well, you could make the argument, and Mark was going in this direction before, based on source number 8, where it says that God created him, male and female, he created them, and based on a verse in Psalms which says, you formed me, God, you formed me back and front. So source number 10, the Talmud, says God made Adam of two faces, meaning that Adam is actually Adam on one side, Eve on the other side, until God says, you know, that's not going to work. And then he splits them apart. Yes, Ricky?
When Eve was created from a part of Adam, Adam was created from that soil, so she is actually has the same material in her because she was originally part of him.
So the material is there, but it's by way of Adam. And the same way, she is subject to the command of not eating from the fruit, but seems to get that instruction by way of Adam. Again, even though they're inhabiting the same body, according to this passage in the Talmud, nonetheless, his personality is the one that is addressed by God. He seems to have the more direct communication. He is the visible and named identity. So she hears from Adam that she shouldn't eat from the fruit. As a matter of fact, following the biblical text, the snake speaks to Eve before God does. Right? The snake speaks to Eve in the beginning of chapter 3. God only talks to her after she's already eaten from the fruit at the end of chapter 3. At that point, she finally hears from God. So, they have two different relationships with God. Adam's relationship is very direct, very close, personal. Eve's relationship comes through Adam.
They have the same DNA no matter how you look at it.
Well, having the same DNA is a really interesting question. That goes back to a Mishnah in Sanhedrin, which is not for right now, about how God makes people from the same minting and yet they all look different. There's a lot to talk about in terms of Eve's DNA. Not for right now, though. So, I think Chava, Eve, is sensitive to this. And perhaps even bothered by it. And I say that because of what happens in chapter 4, when she has children. Who are the children who she produces?
Cain and Abel, Cain and Hevel.
Now, before we sit on this, question, were they born before or after Adam and Eve ate from the fruit?
After.
Right. That's what I would have assumed also, and that's what most commentators say. Rashi actually believes it happened before they ate from the tree, which is fascinating. But most other commentators that I've seen, Ibn Ezra, Radak, Rabbi Yossi Bechor Shor, Rabbeinu Bechai, Ramba, all of them believe it happened in the order it's presented in the Torah, which is to say, after they ate from the tree, after they were evicted from the garden. Right. So just noting that, though. But take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 11. And for anyone who joined after I last posted it, I'm putting the link in the chat again. So this is the beginning of that chapter. And the man was intimate with his wife, Chava, and she conceived and birthed Cain, right? Cain. And she said, I have created, the Hebrew word is kaniti, right? Kaniti Cain. I have created a man with God. And she continued to birth his brother, Hevel, Abel. And Hevel was a shepherd, and Cain was a worker of the land. They're all vegetarian, but you can still use the wool, you get the milk, so Hevel is a shepherd, Cain works the land. Now, the text doesn't give us the meaning for the name Hevel, right? What is the meaning of Hevel? Why would she name him Hevel?
Hevel is breath.
Hevel is breath, right? Hevel is, sometimes it's humidity, it's vapor. The point is something that is not substantive, right? For, we referred before to the book of Ecclesiastes. So they often translate the word Hevel there as vanity. Something that is, that has no substance. He talks about how all is vanity. All is Hevel. So the, so she says, you know, she names him Hevel, so commentators suggest it's a reference to the fact that he doesn't survive. His brother's gonna kill him. Spoiler alert. So that may be the association with his name. Or, alternatively, it is, as Nachmanides says, after they sinned and they were kicked out of the garden, she's very, you know, down. This is a very dark statement of everything is now empty. So she names him that way. She names him Hevel for that reason. Could be. I saw a hand or two. Yes, Claudette.
Back to the verse. It says, created a man with God.
Yes, that's where I'm going with this. That's exactly where I'm going. So Claudette points out the name that Eve uses, that Chava uses, is, I created a man with God. She could have just said, I created a man. The name Cain would have emerged from Kaniti. I did it. I created a man. Kaniti Ish. But she doesn't. She says, Kaniti Ish et Hashem. I created a man with God. Think about the magnitude of what Eve is saying when she names him with this name. Tell me something. How did Adam and Eve get in trouble in chapter 3? What did they do? They ate from the fruit. Why'd they eat from the fruit? Why did they eat that fruit? How did the snake entice her? So it's really interesting. You all saying good things. Take a look on the sheet. To be like God. Take a look, please, at source number 12. The snake says, for God knows that on the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, you will be like Elohim, knowing good and evil. You will be like Elohim. Rashi is bothered. What do they know about God? What do they know about Elohim? Telling them you'll be like Elohim. What do you know? Rashi says, what they know about God is that God creates. They want to be creators. That's what they're looking to do. And because they want to be creators, their punishment is that their creative roles are going to come with pain and suffering. Adam, you are going to create. You are going to bring life from the ground. But it's going to be with sweat and pain and frustration. You're going to plant things and thorns and weeds are going to come up. You're going to think you planted wheat and some other plant is going to show up instead. That's the original curse of manifest in my garden. That's the curse of Adam, is that you're going to produce life with great pain. And Eve, of course, Eve as well, is going to bring life. She's going to bring life from her own body. but with sweat and with pain and with suffering as well. So Chava, Eve, I see your hand, Rose, just hang in there. Eve succeeds in, I see you, Susan, also. Eve succeeds in producing a child, suffering the penalty that God gave her, going through whatever this process is that she has to go through. And she says, I produced a child with God. I have found God. I have achieved religious fulfillment. I have created a relationship with God. I think the reason why she says that is because it wasn't an automatic relationship for her the way that it was with Adam. She had to go looking for it, and not from a voice in a cloud, but in her own creative capacity and working through the sentence that God had given her. That's what I see here. Eve is very cognizant of the fact that she and Adam have different relationships with Hashem. That's what I'm getting at. Okay. Susan, you were going to ask?
Yes, this might be a little off topic, but if Adam and Eve are one, and then he separates this, can this be used today for cloning, like allowing the Fetorah-made cloning? Although after that, there was no more cloning, so to speak.
So Jewish bioethics, by and large, has no problem with cloning. There are technical issues that come up that have to be dealt with. Questions like, who is the mother? is a good question. Determining Jewish identity. Right, we had a class on it in June a few years ago. So we dealt with some of the question then. So I haven't seen this quoted, but it's an interesting point. You're taking the genetic material from Adam and using it to form another human being. I hear what you're saying. Rose, you were going to say? Nope. Okay, Claudette, you were going to say?
I'm thinking about the fact that what Adam and Eve did, God knew that it was going to happen, because God is God, right?
Yes.
And so he knew that he wanted the world to be multiplied by people, and
so it seems.
He was going to do this. He knew that this was going to happen. But I think what he's saying about the pain, maybe, is that you want to taste what it's like to create cause pain, comes with pain.
Right. No, that was that. We're on the same page. That's it. You will be creators, but it's going to be painful to do it. It's going to be difficult. I'm going to now apply this idea to Rosh Hashanah. As we said, right? We're taught that Rosh Hashanah is a day to acknowledge God as king, but different people come to that in different ways. For some people, Rosh Hashanah is the birthday of Adam. You just look at the world and you see God. And faith is easy and faith is straightforward. Of course God is there. You know, when the Jews stand at Sinai, and they hear the first of the Ten Commandments. Take a look at source number 14. I am Hashem, your God, who took you out of Egypt, the house of slaves. And Judaism says, generally by tradition, that this is actually a commandment to believe that. It's really easy when you're standing at a mountain and hearing a voice booming at you from the sky, and the sea split, and there were 10 plagues. It's relatively straightforward to have that belief. Rabbeinu Bachya ibn Pakuda, writing in Spain in the 10th century, and he might be one of the philosophers we talk about in our course in October. I haven't yet decided which philosophers we're going to talk about, but he argues that faith is really the default read of the universe in which we live. By default, you look at the world, and of course you have to believe. Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman, who was killed by the Nazis in World War II, wrote the following in source number 15. He said, faith that God created this world is obvious to any thinking person, so long as he is rational. No philosophy is needed to achieve this knowledge. The foundations of faith are inherently simple and obvious to every rational person. One cannot doubt their truth, so long as one is not bribed, meaning that he seeks the lusts of this world. He says, if you don't believe, then It's because you have some investment in not believing. It's because you have something you want that belief in God would keep you from. So therefore, you're not going to believe. He says, of course, it's clear, crystal clear to him, crystal clear and obvious. For some people, Rosh Hashanah is the birthday of Adam, and they can live that way. And I realize that, you know, for many of us it's not so, that's where we're going. But there are lots of people for whom it's just clear, no challenges, no issues. For many of us, though, Rosh Hashanah is the birthday of Eve, and we need to work at it, to explore the world, and to think about it. And this goes back again, for those who were there yesterday, to my class on Eov, right, on Job. That figures into this. But take a look at what I brought you in source number 16 from Don Isaac Abarbanel, right? We learned about Abarbanel in June. So it's still fresh in our minds for sure. We know all about him. So he has a work called Rosh Amanah, and he's addressing faith, and he says one cannot achieve those beliefs, the belief in God, the belief that God created everything and so on, without prior preparation, knowing that which leads to those beliefs. Doubtless, those preparations are a function of desire and choice and are acquired over time. He says you have to learn philosophy. He wants you to learn philosophy, to explore, and through that you will come to belief in God. But it is a process, and the mitzvah is to work towards emuna. Which, going back to the emailer who I mentioned in the beginning, I think is a very important point for him to recognize. That it's not as though faith is an on-off. You work towards it. And that's what an Eve Jew, a Chava Jew, needs to do, to explore ourselves, to explore and ultimately come to God. You follow so far? We're good? Okay. I want to move from Adam and Eve to Avraham and Avraham, or Abraham and Abraham, if you like. Because the two views of our relationship with God also show up in two distinct midrashim about how Abraham came to God. Eventually, of course, God speaks to him, right? God says, leave your land, leave your the home of your father, and so on. At that point, once God speaks to Abraham, he is an Adam Jew. But he wasn't necessarily an Adam Jew from the beginning. How did Abraham, I keep on going back and forth between Abraham and Abraham, I hope it doesn't frustrate anyone, but how did Abraham come to his relationship with God? How did that happen? How does he discover or meet God?
Well, is that the story of him breaking down the idols?
So him breaking the idols is a story we're going to come to, but that's not his beginning. That's once he's already discovered God.
I think only when he got to Shechem, and they, until then he went, as God told him to go, and only then God told him, this land that you are there, I will give it to you.
But that he already has a relationship from the moment that God speaks to him, right? Meaning, God says, Lech Lecha, before he arrives in Shechem.
Yes, it was the first time that he heard God, who is speaking? He heard a voice.
Yeah.
He didn't know God yet. Mm-hmm. Just him, somebody told him.
Okay. That's it. And he went anyway, not knowing who it was. Wow. That's an interesting way to do things.
That was at 70.
75, actually. But
75.
I want to go in order of the people who wanted to answer. Chana and then Claudette.
He observed the world. By seeing the world, the Midrash says that he was away from the world for when he was little. Why? Then he discovered it when he was already could think.
So Chana suggests he gets to God by observing and concluding that there is a creator. I'm going to come back to that. Claudette, what were you going to say?
I was going to say something along the same line.
Okay.
Because he observed his father's religion and did not believe what he was seeing. So he went and searched.
Right. And Leah writes the same thing in the chat, when he was a child in the cave and he observed the moon and the sun. So we're going to talk about him observing the moon and the sun. No caves in this story, but version number one, there are two versions of this. Version number one, Abraham is just 3 years old when he recognizes his creator. If you take a look at source number 17, it's a Gemara in Nedarim, it's from the Talmud. Avram was three.
But it's all just conjecture.
Not conjecture, but let's follow with me here. Abraham was 3 years old when he recognized his creator. As it says, the text says, God says, because Abraham listened to my voice, the word because, Akev, the gematria of it, the numerical value of those letters, is 172. So that the speaker in the Talmud says, for 172 years, Abram listened to my voice. God lived to be 175. So it must be that he believed in God from the age of 3. Now, it is very clear that that is not the basis for this. It's a nice thing. Hey, the numbers work. But it's clearly not the origin of the idea that Abraham accepts God from the age of 3. So the question is, where does that come from? Well, take a look also at source number 18. You asked about him breaking the idols. Here you go. It's a Medrash in Bereishit Rabbah, which says the following. Terach was an idolater. Once he went out of town, and he assigned Avram to sell idols in his place. When a man came to purchase, Avram, who is young, he's not the one who runs the store, Avram would ask him, how old are you? And he would say, 50, 60. Avram would then say, woe to this person who is 60 years old and yet he wishes to serve a days old idol. We just made that in the factory yesterday. Eshet would leave. Once a woman came bearing a jug of flour. She said to him, this is for you, bring it before the idols. He took an axe in his hand and smashed all the statues, and then he put the axe in the hand of the largest one, the largest statue. When his father returned, he asked, who did this to them? Who did this to to all my merchandise here? All my idols are smashed. He replied, how could I hide it from you? A woman came bearing a jug of flour, and she told me, this is for you. Bring it before the idols. I brought it before them. This one said, I'm going to eat first. This one said, I'm going to eat first. And the largest one took the axe, and he smashed them. His father replied, are you mocking me? Do they know anything? And Avram responded, do your ears not hear what your mouth is saying? And Terach took him and gave him to Nimrod. This is obviously a simplistic explanation of idolatry, right? We understand that people who follow statues don't necessarily think that the statues have powers. It's that the statue represents something else. I get it. I understand. But the point that I'm bringing this for is simply that this is a midrash that is painting Avraham as a child, as someone who recognizes the emptiness of his father's idols. There's another passage in the Midrash in which they say Avraham's kidneys pour forth Torah to him. It just comes out of him, Torah. How in the world can that happen at the age of 3? So Don Isaac Abarbanel says, well, maybe the way to read it is that it's not really saying he's 3. It's saying that it was before he had his Brit Milah, his circumcision, because the foreskin is called an Orla, and that's like Orla 3 years. He has this whole way to reread the Medrash because he's so frustrated by it. But what it's really suggesting is that Avraham simply recognizes God the same way you recognize a relative, right? He's 3 years old. He's coming into some form of intelligence. He's now been weaned, and he's ready to embrace God. Maybe by observing the world, maybe not. The text here is not saying. But when the Talmud tells us that Avram is 3, and this goes back to Rebecca's point about this coming from conjecture, what we're seeing here is a philosophy of how Avram came to God. Avram came to God automatically. He is an Adam Jew. He just comes into the world, gains intelligence, and it clicks for him. Of course there's a God. However, it's not the only version of it. Because you have another Medrash in source number 19, which says, how old was Avraham when he recognized his creator? He was 48 years old when he recognized his creator. Now, the Medrash does not explain why 48. We don't get a neat gematria calculation. I wonder if it's because 48 in gematria would be moach, which is brain. So I don't know if there's any association between that, you know, to explain the 48. However, look at source number 20, Where Maimonides gives you his explanation. Sorry?
Can I ask him, at the fire at Ulpas Dinth, how old was he there?
So, we don't know. The problem we have with that story is that the story does not appear explicitly in the Torah at all. Abraham says, God saved me from Ur Kasdim. And Ur, in Hebrew, can mean a fire. And through things like that, we come out with this midrash about it. There are other pieces that fit into it. It's a bigger midrashic puzzle in terms of reconstructing all the texts that lead the medrash to that result. But we don't have enough evidence to know anything about how old he would have been. So, just the story, the way it's always told, is that he's very young and sounds like it fits into the 3-year-old model, but I don't actually know. So look at Maimonides in source number 20. He says, once this strong one, that's a term for Abraham. In Hebrew, he's the Eitan. We use that term for him in the Rosh Hashanah davening. So once this strong one was weaned, there's the 3-year reference, he began to wander in his thoughts while young. He began to think day and night, and he was surprised. How could this sphere continually function without a director and someone to turn it? It cannot turn itself. And when Maimonides talks about a sphere, he's referring to the Greek cosmology, that the universe is spheres within spheres, and they're turning. So it can't turn on its own, and he lacked any teacher or someone to tell him anything. But he was embedded in Ur Kasdim among foolish star worshippers. And his father and mother and the entire nation worshipped the stars, and he worshipped with them. But his heart wandered and comprehended until he grasped the path of truth, and he understood the path of righteousness from his good understanding. And when he was 40 years old, or in some editions 48, like that midrash that you just saw in 19, Abram recognized his creator. In other words, a very different approach. Maimonides, in his approach, says Abram starts when he's 3, but he doesn't actually get to God until, like this Medrash says, he is 48. And the idea here is that he is an Eve Jew, a Chava Jew. He has to explore in order to come to God. It's not a bolt of lightning, and it's not natural. Those two poles are in Abraham as well. One more biblical figure, Sarah. Is Sarah an Adam Jew or an Eve Jew? Sarah, Abraham's wife, is she an Adam Jew or an Eve Jew?
I would say Eve, because she has the proof, and then she believes she has the proof by having a child, then she believes.
Interesting. So it takes having a child, you think, for her to believe. Could be.
It was the answer to her prayers.
Uh-huh. But then that makes her an Eve Jew because Eve, Kaniti Yishat Hashem.
She didn't get to it right away.
Ah, I see what you're saying. Okay.
So, and the visitors who we assume are God's angels, she overhears that she's going to have a child from God.
And she laughs. Right? She laughs at that. Claudette, you were going to say?
Wouldn't you at 100? Or whatever?
90. She was only 90.
Oh, she was only 90.
As I get older, 90 doesn't seem so old anymore. Yes, Claudette.
Possibly be an Adam Jew because God knew and chose her to make this generation of people.
So God did choose her, but the question is how she perceives it. See, we have two versions of Abraham. Yes, Rose.
So I think she's an Adam Jew, actually, because when you look back at all the different tests, like the test where she went and he was the sister episode.
Yeah.
God saved her. So she must have believed. And she did all those things. I mean, it was way before she had her child.
Okay.
So all these tests, and she was part of the tests.
So here's the way I would frame it. And you compare it with the way you're framing it and decide whichever way you want. To me, Sarah is very much a Chava Jew. God tells Abraham to move. right? Abram is the one who gets the message, Lech lecha me'artzecha, leave your land, leave your family, and so on. Abraham tells Sarah, they're married already based on the text at the end of the Parsha of Noach, and she comes along. God tells Abraham to practice various commandments, right? The mitzvah of circumcision obviously is one of them. Sarah does not get direct instructions from God that we see in the Torah. Sarah gives Abraham another wife, Hagar. God never tells Sarah to do that. She does that on her own intuition. God sends those messengers to Abram that they're going to have a child. The messengers talk to Abram. Abram says to Sarah, would you please make the food for them, right? Which, you know, he makes some and she makes some. Don't think that it was only her doing the cooking. But he's the one who's interacting with the guests. She's in the tent. You know, we are told that Sarah was a nevi'ah. She was a prophetess. But more often, it seems that her role is that she's not contacted directly. She doesn't get a direct conversation with God. And she's honored for the journey that she takes without having the direct conversations. I see you, Susan. Hang in there. If you take a look at source number 21 on the sheet, and God remembered Sarah as he had spoken, and God did for Sarah as he had said, right? That's the Torah reading on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. The text says that God answered Sarah with the birth of Isaac. It doesn't say Abraham. It says Sarah. And there's actually a great midrash on this. I didn't bring it here, but for those who want to look it up, it's Bereishit Rabbah 53:5. About how it's specifically the merit of Sarah that earns Yitzchak, that earns Isaac. And then, when she wants to evict Yishmael from the house, right? Yitzchak is 3 years old. His 17-year-old brother is tormenting him, possibly threatening him. She says, get this teenager out of the house. Abram doesn't want to do it. And God says what you see in source number 22. Whatever Sarah tells you, heed her voice. I stress that he's 17, by the way, because people get very angry about Sarah kicking Yishmael out of the house and they think he's like some little kid or whatever it is. I defy any of you who have had a 17-year-old not to want to kick him out of the house. It just stands to reason. But leave that aside. The point is, God says, you do what Sarah tells you to do. She is honored for that journey that she takes without the direct communication that Adam did. It's not automatic. Susan.
I was wrong, but I thought Hashem sort of told Sarah it was okay to get it, to do that. But the thing that, when everyone says that Ishmael is 17, how then does it say that Hagar carried him?
And the answer is because you carry your child if your child is weak and sick. But he's clearly 17 in the biblical numbers, meaning he's 13 years old when Abraham is 99 and does the Brit Milah, right? And we know that this happens after Yitzchak is weaned, which they're doing at the age of 3. So he is. I mean, how is Hagar carrying him? Maybe he's leaning, or maybe that's what you do when you have a child who's sick. You know, that would be my answer. So, the 17 is straight biblical text. So everything else has to shape itself around that. Rose. So,
there's also a play on words with the he mitzachek with him.
Yes.
Some people say, you know, there may have been some molestation.
So, right. So the word
interpretation of that.
Right, so that's why I said it the way I did. He's either mocking him or threatening him. The sins of Yishmael are not really my topic right now. But yes, there's a lot of discussion about what it was that he did that caused him to be kicked out. It wasn't taking the car out late at night. That wasn't the issue.
But the point that I'm making is it's the right thing for Hashem to say to Abraham, listen to your wife, because yeah. She knows.
Right.
She knows.
Absolutely.
Right?
So, I'm just trying to show you that I think you have a Chava Jew in Sarah. You could make the argument that she is an Adam Jew and that she just does it on her own and it comes to her naturally. You can make that argument. I'm not 100% sure that I'm right. I think I'm right. But Yitzchak's experience, Isaac's experience, will be more like that of Sarah than that of Abraham. God is going to speak to Yitzchak at one point, telling him to stay in Israel during a famine. At that point, he'll speak to him. But at many moments, God doesn't speak to Isaac. He doesn't get that clear message, right? Isaac is taken to be slaughtered. God speaks to Abraham, to Abram about it. He never speaks to Yitzchak, right? One would think you'd want to say something to the carbon, to the sacrifice. Nope. He's just going along with it. Yitzchak is later going to watch his son Esav go off in a bad direction without any word of instruction from God in the text about how to deal with it. He's going to go blind. He's going to be left to witness, without seeing it, but to be aware of, the loss of Joseph, right? Without so much as a whisper from God to explain what's going on. Yitzchak dies without ever seeing Yosef reunited with his family. He's alive for Yosef's disappearance. He doesn't live to see the end of the story. For him, it's much more of what Sarah experiences, it's much more of what Chava experiences. So what I want to get at here is that on Rosh Hashanah, we're really commemorating two birthdays. Adam, who is God's intimate, for whom knowledge of God is an automatic product of his experience, and Eve, who is close to God, but more remote. She receives messages from God via Adam. She prides herself on creating a relationship with God when she endures God's punishment and produces a child. And those two models are found in Midrashim about how Avram came to God. Sarah and Isaac, I think, both fit the Eve model, and therefore they're held up for us as role models. So everyone has role models on Rosh Hashanah as we approach God. Some one, some the other. But all of us have a path. And I want to close with the following thought. I see a long comment in the chat, but I can't do it right now because it's 10:57. Afterwards, I can go back and look. I'll stay around for a few minutes after. Don't worry. There are two different Jewish communities which present problems for the Adam Jew and the Eve Jew. Beyond Rosh Hashanah now, we need to make sure that both Adam and Eve have room in our Jewish communities. There was a poll in 2006 by Baylor University in the U.S., source number 23, I gave you the results, polling people who identified with particular religious streams to ask them what they thought about God. Do they think God is authoritarian, that he zaps people? Do they think that God is benevolent, that he is good and kind and helpful? Do they think that God is critical from afar, watching and ultimately will reward and punish? Do they think that God is distant? He doesn't get involved. He made the world, started it, and now he's off doing his own thing. Or are they atheists? And the number that I bolded and underlined was that 41.7% of Jews responded that they believe God is distant, watching from afar, not really involved. They don't accept God as immanent. And they view the Adam Jew as naive and simple. The Jew who just says, of course God is there. I look at the world, I see a thunderstorm, I see the Rockies, and I recognize God. I see Niagara Falls, I recognize God. And they look at the person and say, we dismiss that. That's, you know, not of substance. And then the other hand, you have the community of Jews who think belief in God should be automatic, who take the view that Rabbi Wasserman offered in the very beginning of the, or not the very beginning, but back earlier in the class, who think that the only way not to believe in God would be if somebody is bribed by their desires. That's what causes them to not believe, right? If you go back to the original email that I quoted, the fellow who emailed me, he said he's desperate to return to the firm world where he once belonged. He feels like he no longer belongs in the community because he can't believe. Both Adam and Eve have to have their place in our communities, lest they feel like they are alone. They're both legit. They both go back to the beginning of the Torah. And people should never mock or deride or exclude someone who has the path that's not theirs. Someone who believes just 'cause, and someone who is really having to work at it and struggle with it. Both are legitimate. You know, there will be, we are taught, the Gemara says it based on a pasuk, based on a verse, that there will be a day when we'll be able to all stand in a circle and point with our fingers and say, Zeh Hashem, there is God, we see God, and we will all be Adam Jews. But until then, it's important that we embrace the descendants of Adam and embrace the descendants of Eve, those who walk a long path of searching and those who are just there, and to help them to reach the stage collectively of Kanisi Ish Es Hashem. I have created a person with God, whether that's creating the child or whether that's creating themselves. Creating oneself with God is also, I think, important. So my blessing to us, to all of us, as we approach Rosh Hashanah, is that we should find whichever model is our model, and also to create a human being, ourselves with God, and we should merit to be inscribed and sealed for a year of health, a year of peace, a year of blessing, a year of nachas, a year of growth. And I look forward to learning with all of you in the year ahead. I'm going to stay around for a few minutes to answer questions and discuss, but thank you very, very much for joining
today.
Thank you,
Rabbi. Thank you.